say maybe a little bit about Marxism. And I'm sure you come here with different levels of background and understanding, and you can help me out with various parts of this, but I'm going to assume that people know very little about Marxism and that there's no prerequisite to this discussion. So if this is repetitious for some of you or you have a different interpretation, then help me out with the discussion. But for those of you who are new to Marxism, then I'll just say a few things about it. I mean, first of all, Karl Marx is probably the most often cited and the least understood political figure in modern history. You know, the highest ratio of both those things, about being quoted and identified and not being very well understood. There's kind of a mythology surrounding Marx and Marxism that for those of us who are sort of trained educationally on this side of the Cold War has a particular kind of legacy to it. Even though the Cold War is over, the legacy has continued. If any of you have experience of having lived or worked on the other side of the former Cold War in Eastern Europe or in China or Cuba, you'll know a different kind of legacy about Marx and the Kuiper mythology. But it's so extensive that there's one biographer of Karl Marx, Hal Draper, who's written a lovely multi-volume collection called Karl Marx's Theory of Revolution, where he refers to the mythology around Marx as actually having created almost a disease. He calls it Marxolia or Marxophagia, where there's this kind of, you know, like there's a whole literature about Marx and Marxism because of how extreme this phenomenon is, which really makes almost no reference to Marx himself. It's completely been unhinged from Marx. And this disease, according to Hal Draper, became particularly rampant among politicians in the West in the 1980s, and he identifies Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and, you know, others of the sort of neoliberal so-called revolution as being particularly adept at spreading this disease among its adherents. But at the same time, there are those who are on the other side of the former Cold War, who were leaders of the USSR under Stalinism or other countries that were affected by Stalinism in Eastern Europe, who, according to Hal Draper, were equally symptomatic. They spread the disease in the same way, this Marxolia or Marxophagia. On the one hand, there was this vilification that Marx represented everything evil. On the other hand, there was this sort of idolatry where Marx was like a religious figure, an icon that could only be worshipped and cited with a kind of biblical tract. And what I think we have to understand if we're going to look at Marx is that both of those views are wrong. And Marx was a very important theoretician, and he was an important political activist, but that's what he was. He carried a body of ideas, and it was an important body of ideas, and there are states that have claimed that they are in the tradition of Marx, where that's debatable, and there are states which have claimed that Marx is this evil, you know, representative of everything that everyone opposes, and that's also debatable. But where do, you know, socialists today stand? Well, I think the best way to look at Marx is in terms of the original ideas that Marx actually developed. Now, of course, those are subject to interpretation. Marx also tended to write prolifically and finish almost nothing in his lifetime. I mean, most of his work was not completed by Marx in his lifetime. Some of it was completed by his collaborator, Frederick Engels, and some has been discovered since then, translated into English, and so on and so forth. But a century before anyone had heard of the Cold War, Marx's ideas were already starting to have an influence during his own lifetime and were already kind of being taken away from his own content. So in Marx's own words, in 1879, he circulated a letter. He died a few years later. He died in 1883, but he circulated a letter declaring somewhat cynically, "If I know nothing else, all I know is that I am no Marxist," and because he was just already objecting to the way this was happening. So what is it about Marx? What was unique about Marx? Well, he maintained that there was a kind of twofold argument that was sort of central to all of his writings. And again, I'm giving you my interpretation, so others of you, you know, might have a different view, but this is how I read Marx in his own writings, that there was this twofold argument. First, he maintained that since the emergence of human society based on social classes, where there were any divisions, not capitalist society, but any society based on social classes, that human history has been governed by certain identifiable laws of motion. And these are laws which operated independently of the ideas in people's heads and independently of the wills of great leaders, that these were social laws. And for Marx, the method through which he identified these laws was based on the premise that human beings form relationships among themselves, that they have a collective relationship with each other and a collective relationship with nature. And those two processes develop at the same time. So all of these relations of human history, these relations are part of how people relate to nature, which Marx called the process of production. That what it's now often referred to as ecology, but for Marx it was the process of production, how human beings change nature in order to live with nature and also to develop themselves at the same time. So that was one idea, this notion of laws of motion based on social relations. The second idea is that Marx maintained that there was the potential that he saw in the particular class society that he was witnessing at its birth stages in his lifetime, which was capitalism. He called it capitalism. That in that mode of production, in that particular form of class relations, there was the potential for the realistic ending of all human wants, of human need. The end of hunger, the end of poverty, and with this would end oppression and exploitation, and the struggle of human beings against other human beings over the earth's resources, which is what was war. So those were the two ideas. One, that there were certain laws of motion, and the second of all, that within the capitalist mode of production, there was the potential for the ending of all human suffering and the potential for a classless society, where the relationship, the social relations of human beings to each other and human beings to nature, those social relations would be put in a situation where the purpose of production would be for the purposes of satisfying human need, which would also involve the preservation of the natural resources that human beings are dependent upon. So there were lots of ways in which Marx came to this perception and how he argued it and how he put it together. And he spent a lot of time trying to figure it out. And through this process, he saw all societies as based on class divisions, or all societies that were based on class divisions, as a product of struggle. And this is what he meant by class struggle. Now, he had a lifelong collaborator. This was Friedrich Engels, who I referred to before. He was his closest friend. He was his co-author. And they worked very closely in developing this common perception. There was, you know, sort of alternating division of labor over this long period of time. But in general, Engels saw himself as the polemicist who dealt with all the people who argued against them, and Marx saw himself as the one who was, like, you know, putting together the philosophy that they agreed with. That was sort of their division of labor, kind of a two-person political party, though political parties didn't really exist in the same way as we know it. Now, Engels described Marx's thought as a development of three separate traditions of radical theory, which came before Marx, but which Marx synthesized and developed in a unique and original way. And these traditions were what he called German idealist philosophy, English political economy, and French socialism. And Marx didn't invent any of them, but he was part of the debates and part of those movements, and he synthesized them. And it seems to me that it's a useful way of understanding Marx's original idea to put them under those headings that Engels created, that Engels discerned. And I'll offer that to you, and then we can talk about it. So these three traditions were all part of the ferment of ideas of European society during the youth and maturation of Karl Marx. And they were all considered radical in Marx's time. Now, we think of radical today usually mean really far left. But at the time, radical meant at the root, changing society at the root, and they were really part of the Enlightenment tradition, which was a whole notion of knowledge. I'm sure any of you with a liberal arts education have encountered this phenomenon, because it's often called modernism. But it was basically about the idea, rather than concepts and knowledge being considered something that were either religious or transmitted through basic texts of the classics, that they were memorized, that knowledge was something that was memorized, or politics was something that was inherited through monarchs. The notion was, through, you know, a century-long process of changing of ideas, that actually knowledge was about investigation, and that human beings create new knowledge. That was a radical idea. And all of these traditions, German idealist philosophy, English political economy, and French socialism, were part of this tradition. So let me just go through each of these in turn, and then we'll talk. Okay, so Marxist thought in terms of German idealist philosophy. Marx developed a very harsh sort of criticism of German philosophy, and he was trained in it. He was a philosophy student. He was German. He was part of this. But the most influential German philosopher of the day was George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And for those of you who are interested in learning more about Hegel, most of his work is translated. Bring a bottle of aspirin, because it's not an easy read. I mean, it gives you like a headache, you know. I mean, he writes in these incredibly long sentences. It's very complicated. It's important to read things in the original. I don't discount that, but brace yourself. Marx is a lot easier to understand than Hegel. But Hegel was very influential in a generation of German students, including Marx and Engels. Hegel died in 1831, just to give you the timing here. And the important thing about Hegel is that he saw history as something that changed and that it was subject to contradictory forces, rather than this linear conception that all development was just sort of like, you know, great leaders or great lords or great gods, you know, developing a body of knowledge that one memorized. Hegel understood that all development, human, social, political, economic development, was the process of contradictory forces. And conflict and transformation, struggle and change, were inherent to Hegel's understanding of the philosophical tradition. So from conflict and transformation, according to Hegel, something higher, something more human, and something also that was closer to what he called the absolute idea, which meant God. This is why it was called idealist philosophy, because the role of the idea was extremely important in it, emerged from this conflict. So, for example, Hegel used this example of the master and the slave. This is just by way of an analogy. Superficially, he said, if you look at the master and the slave, the master is everything. He's all-powerful. And the slave has nothing. The slave doesn't even own his own body. He's owned by the master. And he has to serve the master. He's subordinate to the master. He is nothing. He's lost his humanity. And in that social relationship, the master is all and the slave is nothing. But according to Hegel, appearance and reality are not the same. Something can appear to be one way, and underneath there's an underlying reality. And through criticism, we can identify what that underlying reality is. So second glance, the slave actually is the one who does all the work. The slave transforms nature. The slave is the one who actually has the capacity to labor. And the master is idle. The master can do nothing. He can't even feed himself without the slave. He's wholly dependent upon the slave. So there's the thesis that the master is everything, the slave is nothing. Then there's the antithesis. There's the opposite. This is how development takes place, the contradiction. The slave is everything, and the master is nothing. And then Hegel says, well, actually, no, we need a higher level. We need a synthesis. If the slave came to consciousness and understood how important he was in his own consciousness, he could be freed from the master, because he would see that the master was totally dependent on him. So for Hegel, the unity of the contradiction in the world is overcome in consciousness, in the freedom of the mind, freedom of emancipation. So the slave could be free by believing himself to be so. And this is the importance of the ideal. And I'm grossly, grossly simplifying, okay? But this does avoid the aspirin component, but it's grossly simplified, okay? So because of the ideal in Hegel's thought, this is where the notion of German idealist philosophy comes in. So Marx comes in, where does he look at it? He says, okay, he took from Hegel the focus on transformation and change. He thought this was an extremely important starting point for asking questions about the world. And he agreed that conflict was the core of all development. But instead of seeing development, or what Marx would call dialectics, which is about contradiction and change, being united in the ideal, Marx understood and emphasized material experience, the lived experience of, the, for instance, the slave and the master, of social relations. And he called his and Engels' method came to be called either dialectical materialism or historical materialism. So let's go back to the master-slave analogy. Marx agreed that the appearance is not the same as reality. He agreed that there was thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. First glance, the master is everything, the slave is nothing. He agreed. Second glance, the slave is everything, the master is nothing. Okay, that's true. Labor is extremely important. The fact that the slave transforms nature is extremely important. But is the slave really free when he thinks he's free? Marx says no. The synthesis occurs when the slave actually overthrows the master and lives the world without a master as a free man. When you move from real slavery to real freedom in the material world. And until that time, the contradiction is not resolved. So Marx said that Hegel understood the dialectic, but he had it upside down. He said the dialectic is standing on its head, where people are actually walking on their heads. Their heads are holding them up. He says we have to reverse it. We have to put it right side up so that we're standing on our feet. And our minds are very important. We use our minds, human beings use their minds to transform the world, but we have to transform it in ways that we actually change the way we walk, the way we live in the world. So that's the component of German idealist philosophy. But that's not all. English political economy. What about English political economy? In 1850, Marx was forced into exile, and he moved to Britain from Germany. There was an aborted revolution, a democratic revolution in 1848 that Marx and Engels participated in, and they became basically refugees. Well, Engels was British originally, but and David, he moved with his family in Britain. But Marx went into exile and lived away from Germany and spent some years basically studying. And this is the period of time that he worked in the British Museum Library that has become a famous place of Marx's work. And he read at that point in detail about the question that was asked by the British political economist. He had come from Hegelian philosophy and decided that the key thing was studying the real world. So he tried to study the real world and he discovered British political economy as a method of understanding the real world. This is where he wrote Capital, which is his most famous work, and the first volume of which he did complete. That was one of his success stories in terms of deadline. But it was only the first of three volumes, and there were theories of surplus value afterwards that he didn't complete. It was still in notebooks. But he studied the development of society historically, and the notion of political economy was that politics and economics were linked. It was understood in the British intellectual tradition. And he studied thinkers like Adam Smith, who we know today. He wrote the book called The Wealth of Nations. There are many liberal economists in sort of the tradition of modern economics who still see Adam Smith as kind of a founding father of modern economic theory. And Smith maintained that capitalism and market competition were natural to the human condition. So he studied capitalism in some detail. Now, Marx became very interested in capitalism because it was the form of class society in which he was seeing, and he saw development and change taking place. And he disagreed with Marx's conclusion, with Smith's conclusion, but he agreed that capitalism was extremely important. So the essential elements of Marx's argument was that capitalism and the market were very important, but they weren't the natural form of human society. He didn't believe that human nature was essentially competitive and avaricious. He saw it as one of several phases of development along the lines of Hegel's notion of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So he actually looked at the capitalist mode of production as one of a series of modes of production that will change over time, that it came from somewhere and it could go somewhere. So capitalism, according to Marx, was not natural, it wasn't permanent, but it coincided with a specific stage of human social and political development. And he understood it, the way he put it is that capitalism, according to Marx, could only be understood in terms of, quote, the birth, life, and death of a given social organism and its replacement by another superior order. So at the core of the contradiction of all class societies with class struggle, and at the core of the contradiction of capitalist society, was a particular form of class struggle, a particular type of organization of human beings with each other and human beings in relationship to the natural world. So on one side, Marx said there is a class of capitalists. They own and control the vast means of production that creates the productive wealth of society. And on the other side is a vast number of people who don't own the capacity to produce. What they own is their physical bodies and their capacity to labor. And for Marx, he saw capitalism as a progressive stage of human development relative to other stages of human development because of its productive capacity, because it had the capacity to transform nature and to create wealth on a level that was much higher than any other society, than slavery or than feudalism or than the Asiatic mode of production. But at the same time, he understood contradiction. So capitalism wasn't only progressive, it was also the most destructive and the most soul-destroying of any form of society that had ever existed. Both of these things at the same time. He identified it as dripping from head to foot, from every pore, with blood and dirt. So capitalism was a system that was based on competition that Marx saw as socially created. Adam Smith didn't see this. Adam Smith said this is what is human about us, is that we are competitive, that we're individualistic, that we fight against one another, and that's what makes us different than all the other animals. That's what makes us so productive. Marx said no. Capitalism creates competition among capitalists, but it also creates a huge amount of cooperation among the working class. It takes people from all corners of the world who know nothing about one another, puts them together in a common circumstance, and creates the basis of a tremendously high level of sharing and cooperation and common labor. And he saw within that contradiction the potential that this could be the last class division in human history. That this was such an extreme class division that it saw the potential to eliminate all class contradiction. And that he saw within the working class, this collectively laboring population that owned nothing except their capacity to work, the potential that if they took control of this potential of wealth, of this huge amount of productive capital, and produced it not with this avaricious competitive side, but for the purposes of satisfying human need, he saw the potential of what he called the end of prehistory, the end of humanity's struggle to find its humanity, in a certain sense. And with the end of this class society, we would find a way of living in such a way that the production of the purpose of production was for human need, and human need in collaboration with the natural world that we were in. But this still wasn't the end of his framework. Enter French socialism. Now, Marx was a socialist. That's sort of obvious. But it's not true that he was the first socialist, and it's not true that he was the original socialist or the only socialist. He was a product of a series of debates of a whole lot of socialists and different conceptions of socialists, and he developed a particular take on socialism. He was influenced by socialists that preceded his original contribution, and France was the center of this tradition. And I know socialists in France who maintain that it's still the center of this tradition. They point to, you know, the 1995 general strike and the youth movement and the riots that have currently happened. They say it's still France is, you know, 1968 in France. I mean, that France is still the center of socialism. It's a debatable point, but Marx actually agreed with them many centuries before their lives. So Marx studied the democratic tradition in France and the socialist tradition, and they were very closely linked. So the French Revolution, the revolution that we would call a bourgeois revolution, the revolution of liberal democracy, took place in 1789 against the French monarchy. And Marx actually tried very hard to imitate this in Germany. This is what the 1848 revolution was about, and failed. Spent a lot of his life just reviling the low cultural level of the Germans and the high cultural level of the French because of this. But it was during his lifetime, in 1871, that Marx became profoundly influenced by a certain event that happened in France, and this was the Paris Commune that took place in 1871. And it was, for Marx, the first historical moment when he called it a newly formed working class. It was very different than the working class that we know of today, but people who had no capacity to work except for others. They were journeymen or recently unemployed peasants and so on. But Marx saw a wave of the future with the phenomenon of, for a short period of time, the working class taking control of their society in Paris and running society without bosses and without rulers. Thank you. And he saw within the Paris Commune the potential for what he called capitalism's own gravedigger. That the working class, or the proletariat, the landless, the working class that owns no land, that only has their capacity to labor, who work for capital, he said was the core of the socialist emancipation of all humanity. Not because they're special, not because they're smarter, they might not even be literate, they wouldn't necessarily even know their own class interests, they weren't necessarily a class for itself, they were a class in themselves, but because they were collectively laboring, And if they had the capacity to emancipate themselves, to take control of what they produced, then that was the basis for a form of society which was basically a kind of workers' council. There was a democratically elected government that came from the people, from below, that Marx saw as the what he called as the political form at last discovered for the emancipation of the working class as a whole. Now, Marx saw this as realistic. And because he actually saw it in his lifetime, he said, we have a laboratory in the Paris Commune. It was short-lived, and it was temporary. It was precursory, you know, many aspects of the working class. But he said, this is not utopian. This is not imaginary. This is not religious. This is not an ideal in an abstract sense. This is something that's realistic. And other socialists of his day, he described as utopian socialists. They had a conception of creating a socialist world, but it was a small utopia, either a small village that was sort of a where there was some kind of social welfare, or a blueprint of an alternative society, and people were Owen in England or Fourier in France. They literally made up sort of model villages and so on. And Marx saw this as very patronizing, as very top-down. There were these elite intellectuals who would tell these poor people how they could live under their direction and under their pay and you know, under their model. And he said, no. The key thing is that socialism is the emancipation of the working class, self-emancipation of the working class, or it is nothing. And the way we understand the self-emancipation of the working class is not by looking at other states. There were no states that called themselves socialists, but by looking at capitalism, by looking at the people who do the labor, who support the entire capitalist system. So Marx didn't see socialism as inevitable. He did see, however, as inevitable, the deepening of the contradictions of capitalism. And he thought as those contradictions deepened, as the exploiting class became more exploited, and the working class became larger, and took over more and more sections of the agricultural population, became workers who had no relationship with their land. They couldn't subsist through their own labor. They had to subsist through the labor, through working for someone else. As that contradiction increased, Marx predicted that the two contending classes would go into deeper and deeper struggle against one another, and that the competitive urge of the capitalists would force them in competition with other capitalists to the point of war and potentially barbarism. So he saw what was inevitable was the deepening contradictions of capitalism, which would either be resolved with socialism, or it would lead to the mutual destruction of the two contending classes, what Rosa Luxemburg years later called either socialism or barbarism. So he saw one of those two outcomes as inevitable, but not necessarily the socialist outcome as inevitable. So he identified a tendency for capitalism to expand. He anticipated that he saw these laws of motion in capitalism in its infancy that was going to move outside of borders, move to other portions of the world, and that would create these contradictions internationally. And anticipated that the socialist tradition from France, through not the intellectual, but through the sans-culottes, the poor, the poorest sections of the French proletariat, would be the vision of the future. And that those three components, the German philosophical method, which meant you understand how to ask the questions, basically, that the world is not, don't trust the appearances, ask beyond the appearances, look for the contradictions. The second one, British political economy, focus on capitalism because we're living in it, he was living in it, and see the way in which the capitalist dynamic is something completely different than any other mode of production, but understands its weaknesses as well as its strengths. And the third thing is, look to the working class. That's what he learned from the French socialist tradition. Those three components, Engels saw as what Marx's contribution was throughout his life. Now, what do we think about that for today? Arguably, we still live under capitalism, that the mode of production that Marx started to identify has not been fundamentally replaced by another mode of production. At the same time, it's very, very, very greatly different than it was in Marx's time. And to approach Marx as sort of a biblical tract that, you know, we will hold on to capital and put every jot and tittle, is not a very useful way of understanding Marx's views. Marx himself lived in conditions that are extremely different than what we have today. But why do people keep reading Marx? I mean, Marx has been declared dead and Marxism has been declared dead. I mean, in my intellectual lifetime, I've seen it twice, you know, that Marxism is irrelevant, we should all stop reading it, so on and so forth. And it just reemerges that his work keeps getting translated. The Communist Manifesto was a bestseller when it was reprinted recently. I mean, why does this happen? To my mind, the reason we keep coming back to Marx is because there's something about the world we live in today that makes us ask the same types of questions that Marx was asking. And to know that we're not the first to do it is really comforting. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We have to keep the wheels turning. We have to do our work. We have to, you know, build on a tradition with our own eyes and ears and look at the world around us. But to know that there is a body of theory, that there's a body of work that is actually helpful in asking the same kinds of questions about a world that's very similar to today means, I think, that there is a real grounds to say that Marxism is not dead, but it's a living tradition, and it's a very powerful tradition. Because to assume that this corporate monster that we live in globally is something that is not human nature, that it's out of our nature, that it's in the control of a small class of people, that it needs to actually be replaced with something different, is an idea that I think still has a tremendous amount of merit. And it's certainly worth thinking of Marx's ideas as something that's relevant for the class struggle today. So I'll leave it there.